and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the return of Congress after a seven-week vacation, bringing with them a return of gridlock, with the Republican Senate playing politics by reviving the same rejected Zika funding bill with poison pill provisions to defund Planned Parenthood that is dead on arrival. Janet Reitman, an investigative journalist and contributing editor to Rolling Stone, joins us to discuss her latest article at Rolling Stone, Zika, the Epidemic at America's Door. She will discuss her reporting from Puerto Rico, where already 80,000 Americans are infected, with public health estimates that up to 875,000 of the island's 3.5 million people will be infected by the end of the year. We'll assess whether the Republican Congress will be held accountable for allowing the epidemic to spread, particularly in the solidly Republican states whose representatives claim to care deeply about the lives of the unborn, who, if infected with Zika, will enter the world deformed by microcephaly, assuming the disease is allowed to spread because lawmakers in the southern states would rather protect the Confederate flag than the pregnant women of America. Then we'll follow up on earlier speculation that Vladimir Putin was planning a new war with Ukraine and speak with Michael Kaufman, a fellow at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute, who has an article at Foreign Policy, Putin's military is playing the long game in Ukraine. We will discuss the likelihood that the troop buildup and military maneuvers the Russians are engaged in Crimea and the Donbass, are exercises meant to increase psychological and political pressure on Ukraine, as opposed to Russian war games being a springboard for a real attack. Then finally, we'll examine Donald Trump's immigration proposals delivered with strident nativism and racially charged venom recently in Arizona in front of a raucous cheering crowd who sounded like a lynch mob. The former commissioner of the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service under President Bill Clinton, Doris Meisner, who is now a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, joins us to discuss the radical break that Trump's extreme vetting would be from America's traditions as a nation of immigrants with what amounts to loyalty oaths and xenophobic litmus tests replacing the welcome to, quote, the tired and poor huddled masses yearning to breathe free, inscribed on the Statue of Liberty. And joining us now is Janet Reitman, who's an investigative journalist and contributing editor to Rolling Stone. She's the author of Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion, and she has an article at Rolling Stone, Zika, the Epidemic at America's Door. Welcome to Background Briefing, Janet Reitman.
Thanks so much for having me.
And the Congress is back, and the Senate is going to basically revive the same bill for $1.1 billion in spending for Zika, but it also has the poison pill of shutting down Planned Parenthood, so it's going to be dead on arrival. So do you think that this crisis that you've written about so clearly, and it is a clear and present danger, is it going to be addressed?
I really have no idea. I think that's the honest answer. I would hope so. They've certainly been given, ample warning. I mean, this has been an issue. You know, even if you remember in the spring, you had Republicans like Marco Rubio or, Senator Tim Scott from Florida, urging President Obama to do something. Rubio is urging, the Congress to do something. I mean, you have. People of both parties that have expressed tremendous concern over Zika, and it's become a politicized issue. And tacking on the Planned Parenthood thing is just, ensuring that the people that actually, need the help. And in my reporting, I reported mostly in Puerto Rico. And so I was looking at the people in the United States and its territories that are the most at risk are the people, of places like Puerto Rico, and they're not getting anything.
And when you were in Puerto Rico yourself, were you worried? I mean, it sounds...
No. No, I mean, I think the thing with Zika, is, and I think this is becoming, increasingly clear that, Zika is carried by the same mosquito that carries, dengue fever, that has carried, a chikungunya, which is another sort of tropical illness. And it's a much milder form of of this. So, you know, the majority of people that will come down with Zika will not have any symptoms. They may develop, you know, like a low-grade fever or a rash, and then it'll go away. I mean, the real risk at the moment, you know, what we know, the real risk is to pregnant women and to unborn babies, to babies. And developmentally, we don't know whether or not children that have been infected with Zika when their mothers were pregnant, and even if they're born, you know, seemingly like quote unquote normal without signs of microcephaly, which is this, you know, small head syndrome, you know, they may have other developmental issues that could take quite some time to emerge. And that's really the issue. It's, you know, in terms of when I talk to the doctors at places like the CDC, for example, what they brought up was that, you know, the kind of the closest sort of epidemic of this type was rubella, which, you know, is something that most people don't remember. I mean, I think that was in 1964, and that infected pregnant women, and it was something that, you know, caused birth defects. But in terms of, you know, the general population, you know, the adult population being concerned about Zika, I certainly wasn't really worried about it. I mean, I use bug spray. But I think there's a tremendous amount of hype about this, and I think that, you know, on the one hand, it's something if you're you know, a young woman who's planning to become pregnant, or if you are pregnant, that is something that I would definitely be worried about. But if, you know, if that's not something that you're you know, thinking about at the moment, then you know, then it's not as big of a concern, you know, in terms of your own personal health. Now, like, what I will say, having just said all of that, is that if you live in, you know, in cities or in particularly in impoverished areas where people live really close together, the thing with Zika is that the mosquito that carries Zika is not really a very distant traveler. So the mosquito will bite somebody and then it will kind of hop over not very far and possibly bite somebody else. And that's how it's spread. So in a certain sense, you know, we do have to be aware that even if we personally are not concerned about Zika, you know, are not getting pregnant or are, you know, just not focused on that, that, you know, us having, you know, somebody like me or someone else having Zika and then getting bitten and then that mosquito biting somebody who is thinking about getting pregnant or who is pregnant, that's the concern. That's the worry. So there is a kind of like community responsibility aspect of this, and that's, I think, really why Congress should act, because this is really, in that kind of larger sense, like a global sense, I mean, this is a disease that does affect everybody.
But already there are about 1,300 recorded cases of Zika on the island of Puerto Rico, and estimates from health officials say there may in fact be up to 80,000. And then also public health estimates say that there could be up to 875,000 of the island's 3.5 million people infected by the end of the year. So that's a massive specter of this thing getting out of control. It seems as if in many ways it is out of control in Puerto Rico itself. I know it's on a minor scale in Miami, but they are American mosquitoes, if I can call Aedes aegypti an American mosquito. Their host is people. They're people-centric. And they are now infected with Zika in the United States, continental United States.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the thing that I stressed in my story and that, you know, health officials, you know, people at the CDC who are not, you know, trying to not be too alarmist about this, and I think, you know, rationally so, is that, yes, these Aedes aegypti mosquitoes are American mosquitoes, as you say. They are present in parts of the continental United States. Still, the vast number of cases of Zika in the continental U.S. are from people who picked this up, having, you know, traveled to a Zika-infected country or region like Puerto Rico or the Bahamas, and then returned to the United States infected. there is no evidence at this point that Zika is kind of like AIDS that can be, you know, trans. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about and fear about its sexual transmission. And while that has happened, at least what the doctors that I interviewed told me was that there is no evidence that Zika, the virus, kind of remains in bodily fluids for a really long time. I mean, it could be, you know, it certainly is, could be a couple of weeks. It might even be months. But, you know, it's not like you can be infected with Zika in July and then, you know, infect somebody else through sex in November. That doesn't seem likely. So, you know, that aspect of it sort of reduces the scariness in a way, I'll sort of temper that, of it becoming completely out of control in the U.S. The issue is mosquito eradication, you know, public education. We in the U.S., in the continental U.S., are already in a much more privileged position because we have air conditioning in most of our buildings. Most people have window screens, you know, all the things that keep mosquitoes at bay. But when you go into, you know, regions like Puerto Rico or particularly countries like Haiti, which is another place that I've been to several times, and they have right now a huge problem with Zika, but there's no way that they can police, you know, women and get, you know, police pregnant women or, you know, enforce anything like screens or even bug spray. I mean, it's all to them rather laughable because of the kind of conditions that they live in, which are fairly squalid. In Puerto Rico, certainly it's not that way, but, you know, there too, they don't have a tradition of using screens. There are some, you know, some really poor areas that are, you know, quite remote, and there's an innate distrust in many cases of doctors. Their health system is falling apart. I mean, the country financially is in a crisis. Excuse me, the region, the territory of Puerto Rico, which is part of the U.S., is in a crisis financially, and that's contributing to all of this because it's for a whole variety of reasons people are dissuaded from taking this very seriously, from perhaps seeking the appropriate amount of help, from being able to afford it, and so it's a crisis that becomes compounded, and they really do need help at this point from the federal government, which provides Puerto Rico with its money, and they're not getting it.
But when you say, though, Janet Reitman, that it's not as serious and fatal as AIDS, and that we shouldn't, you know, put it in
that we know of. Let's say that we know of.
Sure.
At the moment.
But I don't think you can quantify the extreme anxiety that a pregnant woman must feel, knowing that she could be bitten by a mosquito.
And
on top of that, I find it deeply ironic that the states in this country that are most likely to be infected by Zika through the mosquitoes that exist in the south of this country are mostly red states, and the Republicans are the ones that are holding up the funding for, you know, wanting to protect the Confederate flag. And these are people who at any given moment will talk about how much they care about the life of the unborn. So here you've got a woman with the life of the unborn literally in jeopardy, and if she does give birth to a child with microcephaly, that in itself is a tragedy for the family and an expense for the taxpayer, and a massive expense for the taxpayer.
I know, I agree, and I think that what's going to happen is that, you know, if and when, God forbid, you do start seeing women in this country being infected with Zika and then giving birth to children with microcephaly, this will have an impact. I really do believe this. But, you know, there's a kind of out of sight, out of mind philosophy that we have. I mean, that Puerto Rico itself has not had the kind of sort of skyrocketing, dramatic rates of this that, say, you know, Brazil had, or Colombia. So the Puerto Ricans themselves, in some cases, are not as concerned as you would think that, you know, they should be. They have a kind of more like a little bit of a laissez-faire attitude. Though not, certainly not all of them. I met plenty of very anxious pregnant women in Puerto Rico and here in the U.S. I mean, in Miami, there are women that don't even want to leave their house if they're pregnant. So I totally understand that. I think that it's It's incredibly intense. What I was talking about in terms of you know, any kind of equivalence to AIDS is that in terms of a national pandemic, in terms of something that becomes something to that level, that is reliant on the ability of this kind of virus to be spread that easily throughout the population. And I don't necessarily, you know, see that as the case. And certainly I've not been told that by health officials. But, you know, it's a tremendous problem. It's causing, you know, massive amounts of anxiety for women. And we don't know what the impact on children is going to be. I mean, it's not, you know, what's, you know, really important to remember is that microcephaly is the most extreme outcome of a Zika infection, the least extreme being nothing. So there's got to be something in between there in this continuum. And that's what, you know, doctors do not know yet and may not know for some time. And so we may, you know, we may see a development in the next year or 2 years or 3 years of, you know, an uptick in all kinds of developmental issues that could, you know, be traced back to Zika. We just don't know. And that's why I think it is really important for the Congress to act, for money to be allocated for you know, local, you know, governments and the states and the territories of this country to have what they need, and they haven't gotten it yet.
Well, Janet Reitman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Janet Reitman, who's an investigative journalist and contributing editor to Rolling Stone. She's the author of Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. And she has an article at Rolling Stone, Zika, The Epidemic at America's Door. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back following up on whether Putin is planning to start a new war with Ukraine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Kaufman, who's a fellow at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute, who has represented the Department of Defense in a number of Track 1 and Track 2 efforts with Russia and Pakistan. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Putin's military is playing the long game in Ukraine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Kaufman.
Yeah, thanks for having me on your program.
And I've had a few interviews about the Russian military buildup in Ukraine, and particularly Crimea. I spoke with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, a military analyst with Novaya Gazeta, which is one of the few newspapers not controlled by the Kremlin in Russia, along with Andrew Cutchins at Georgetown and others. And the impression I got, particularly from Pavel Felgenhauer, was he thought there was a 50-50 chance of this being a real war as opposed to using military leverage to rattle the Ukrainians. I take it you don't think that's the case. You think this is more of posturing than an actual preparation for war.
Right. I know Pavel and Andy both personally, and I rather like him, but yes, indeed, I think Pavel's wrong. And this extent of military activity, it's not really posturing. The military activity is part of a series of planned exercises and operational deployments, and this is the training season that begins in August and goes through September for Russia. But the other part of it is really a long-term plan to permanently base Russian military forces around Ukraine and essentially put Ukraine into a vice. And this is kind of the future Russia envisions for late 2017 and moving forward.
So you don't think that Putin would need to move westward along the, from Crimea through Odessa and link up with Transnistria in Moldova?
Yeah, that never made sense. It didn't make sense when people first started saying it in early 2014. It hasn't made sense since either. There are certain military realities that make that quite problematic. And the two of them are, one, Ukraine is a very, very large country. It's geographically actually the largest country in Europe, which some people don't know. And two, Russia's army and land force isn't that large, and there simply isn't the manpower and military capability for Russia to secure a corridor, either from Russia to Crimea or Crimea to Transnistria or any permutation thereof of these theories, which is why it's never taken place.
And the bridge that Putin's crony, Arkady Rutenberg, is in charge of building, the 90-kilometer bridge across the Kerch Straits there, which are a very troublesome engineering project in itself, and I understand there's, you know, quite a lot of kleptocratic activities going on. Where does that stand? Is that an issue? In other words, one of the theories was, well, Putin needs to push through from the Donbas into Crimea to create a land corridor because this bridge is proving troublesome.
Hmm. Yeah. No. Like I said, it's not really possible to do that, to create this land bridge with Russian forces. It would require taking all of southeastern Ukraine, which is just a huge piece of real estate. Two, Ukrainians for a long time have told me that building this bridge would be too difficult from an engineering standpoint, and yet the bridge continues apace. And the energy bridge, meaning the electricity link between Russia and Ukraine, Ukraine's Crimea, had already gone active last November. I actually believe this bridge will be built. I think, like as on many things, I hear these sort of categorical statements that later on end up being proven wrong, that this bridge will end up working. With respect to how much money is being spent on it, I think it will cost billions of dollars, but I'm not sure it will be a kleptocratic enterprise, because I believe that Arkady Rutenberg is actually going to spend some of his own money to build this bridge. You may wonder why he would do such a thing. I'll tell you that this bridge is essentially a personal monument that the Rutenbergs are building as sort of a testament of their loyalty and whatnot. And if it is a success, I imagine it'll leave a lasting impression. So I'm not really sure to what extent the bridge will be a common case of theft from the Russian treasury, like a lot of these projects are, versus ultimately a tax on the Rutenbergs to put in some of their own money, since they've made billions off the Russian public over the years.
So let's talk about the long game, and I think you've put to rest the idea that there's going to be another war there, which is certainly an alarming prospect, and particularly in a presidential year. And the, one of the theories put forth was that this will be a repeat of what happened in 2008 with Georgia, the attack that on Georgia that happened during the Olympics and during an American presidential election. The Olympics are over, of course, and it didn't happen. So what is Putin really up to then?
Right. Well, I think part of the problem is people are making predictions as though we're sort of late in 2013, right, and a state of peace exists between Russia and Ukraine. But that's not the case. So having seized Crimea and with Russian forces rotating freely through eastern Ukraine, Russia doesn't need any sort of elaborate pretext or subterfuge or disguised exercise to invade Ukraine, right? It's already in Ukraine. And that's why these sort of notional ideas about what this could be didn't make much sense. In terms of Russian military activity, I think we often miss the strategic picture because we always tune into Ukraine when the fighting picks up, and then we tune out when the fighting dies down. Russia is really looking at, what does Ukraine represent 5 to 10 years from now? Ukraine has pretty capable defense industry. It has the manpower to put together a pretty sizable ground force army. And Russia's concern is what a real round two might look like, a rematch down the line, make sure that they can deter conventionally any notions in Ukraine that they could retake the separatist regions, or alternatively, in a more ideal hypothetical future, the Minsk agreement is followed through, Russian forces withdraw from eastern Ukraine, but the way they make Ukraine stick to those terms is to have large permanent formations in the form of divisions and brigades around Ukraine, so that Ukraine is sort of permanently under threat from Russian military.
So Pavel Felgenhauer made the case, or made the argument, that he believes that Putin honestly believes that the Ukrainians are brothers, and that that it's the U.S., the mendacious United States, that has severed this fraternal bond through, you know, the chicanery of the I can't Mary de Kagan.
Victoria Nuland.
Yeah, Victoria Nuland and others, and that these colored revolutions have all been engineered by the CIA, and that it's really there's no authentic Ukrainian independence movement. Do you think that Putin actually believes that?
Well, I think the latter part definitely is a good summary of Russian elite outlooks and strategic culture, that most of these popular movements and uprisings are not expressions of free popular will, but are actually instigated by the United States and sort of Western forces. That's true. With respect to brotherhood and all that, I do believe that the ruling elite in Russia had generally seen Ukraine as not being a real country. And they had sort of notions, assumptions about Ukraine, which, by the way, in my view, were inaccurate, but fairly commonly held and fair notions to hold, given how young of a country Ukraine was, to have these sort of untested assumptions. I don't know what they believe now, and I typically I focus on military analysis, and I try to refrain from sort of amateur Freudian psychoanalysis of Vladimir Putin that a lot of people like to do in the Russia field. But I will tell you that, yeah, I suspect Vladimir Putin believes that Ukrainians and Russians share a common history, common culture, and heritage, and that a lot of these are divisions, the political boundaries in the post-Soviet world, are artificial impositions.
Well, we know that that there is a Russian role in the U.S. election so far, which is pretty unprecedented, and it does seem that Putin has pushed the envelope, not just in terms of seizing Crimea and destabilizing the east of Ukraine, but also his fingerprints, or Russian fingerprints, on the hack of the DNC would indicate to me that maybe Putin, you know, normally when foreign intelligence services do this kind of hacking, they don't leave their fingerprints. And Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear more or less said, hello, you know, screw you guys, it's us, you know. So is there something going on there in terms of Putin basically wanting us to know that he really believes that we've interfered in his neighborhood and he's going to interfere in our elections?
Yeah, I think you have it quite right. One thing that I don't think this is an attempt to somehow help Donald Trump's campaign, nor do Russians believe that they really understand the U.S. system, that they could somehow influence this decision. I assure you, looking at it from Washington, D.C., neither of the two main political parties have been that great here at influencing the course of the campaign this year. However, I do think that this dates back to, one, a personal bit of business that the Russian elite has with Hillary Clinton over what they feel was her outspoken support late in December 2011 of Russian protests in Moscow against the then stolen parliamentary election Russia had, and subsequently the stolen election that they had in 2012 that reelected Vladimir Putin as president. The second part of it is to show the United States that Russia does have the ability to really mess with sort of the procedural element of our democracy, which, as you can imagine, in this country is held as a very critical and important thing. And it is, in some respects, unprecedented. Now, have they really influenced this election? No, but I believe that the reason they have left these very clear marks is to show that they could, and that they could damage public faith in the procedural sort of foundations of our democracy, which is a very serious thing.
But in terms of what they can do as the election season heats up, now that the Labor Day weekend is the turning point in terms of people paying more attention and debates are coming up. So we know our election's going to intensify. There's Julian Assange of WikiLeaks has made it clear that he's got a lot more ammunition that he wants to try and shoot down Hillary Clinton with. So a lot of analysts think that there is a Russian intelligence connection to Assange and Edward Snowden. So is there a possibility that there's an awful lot of stuff that they've gotten through intercepts and other technical means to have some real dirt on Hillary Clinton?
There is, although that statement you made by implication assumes that Hillary Clinton does things that would create the sort of dirt. But I will tell you, of course, there is. And I think WikiLeaks and Julian Assange are naturally being used in this way by Russian intelligence. Russian intelligence sees their job as to essentially provide the ammunition. And then a third party like WikiLeaks gives it a sense of more credibility and impartiality. I think from the Russian perspective, they are doing to the United States what they thought the United States was trying to do to them and Vladimir Putin in the Panama Papers, that disclosed that sort of his close associate and good friend, a known violinist, was actually involved in a whole bunch of malfeasance and laundering money. So from Russian perspective, I think that this is all fair and in some respect will deserve vengeance. What could they release as this comes up is anybody's guess. So Julian Assange may have lots of things they've given them, but I doubt any of them are really shocking or that good, nor am I certain that it'll really influence the election in a serious way. Our elections are not so easily influenced and manipulated, even by internal forces here in the United States.
Well, that certainly would explain why Julian Assange went after the Panama Papers, which was done by a consortium of international investigative journalists. Some people thought it was some kind of institutional jealousy, but he really went after the release of the Panama Papers, which would indicate that he really does have a relationship with the FSB or the SVR.
Yeah, I mean, I think him and his organization in general are being used, and they're being used by people who share similar views. I mean, Julian Assange, if I remember, even had, when he was stuck at that embassy, he even had a program on RT. I mean, how did he get that program? So many appearances.
Sure.
Russia's main television network.
Well, back to Ukraine then. You don't see any kind of October surprise there. And if, as you mentioned earlier, Michael Coffin, that you don't think that Putin is necessarily trying to help elect Donald Trump as so much to let Hillary Clinton know that he can rattle our cage. What do you think going forward is likely to happen then? Is we know that Putin would like to get these sanctions, get some relief from these sanctions, and can he peel off anybody in terms of Western Europe? The Italians are having their Brexit vote in October. The Nobel economist Joe Stiglitz is quite concerned that the Italians are going to follow the British with their Brexit, which is really going to screw up the euro. So do you think that Western Europe is going to be shaky for a while, and how much is that going to help Putin?
Right. I think the way the sanctions are structured right now, no individual country wants to be the one that breaks the sanctions regime, but there is a pretty large constellation of countries and had been there in part from the beginning that were never interested in sanctions and would like to see them lifted from Russia. I do believe that the political will and the overall consensus on the sanctions has steadily been weakening, and more than likely, if sanctions themselves don't get lifted after this round, then they may very well be weakened, meaning there will be still sanctions imposed on Russia, but the meat of the sanctions will start to disappear. And different countries will lobby for that not just Italy. In fact, most of Central Europe will too. Austria, Czech Republic, Hungary. There's a constituency there. Does it help with your Putin? Yes, of course. The sanctions thing is a double-edged sword because I can tell you Russia does want sanctions lifted, but for two reasons. One, later next year when its economy may have the opportunity to bottom out, Russia really does need access to Western capital. Two, part of the problems with the sanctions that in response to the sanctions, Russia sanctioned itself, and it sanctioned a whole lot of Western food imports, which really limited Russian access to Western agricultural products and also drove up prices massively in inflation. And this creates public discontent more. The sanctions overall, just so you know, were actually a huge political flavor to Moscow because most of the damage from falling oil prices and economic recession have been blamed on Western sanctions. And in fact, we did a large favor to them for the last 2 years. If you go to Russia, you can tell that probably the best example of the fact that the West does not have a regime change policy towards Moscow is sanctions, because sanctions has allowed them to alleviate all the political damage and blame that they would have taken for the state of the economy over the last 2 years, or at least large parts of it.
Well, it is often the way, isn't it, that sanctions are more about making us feel good than being effective.
Yeah, absolutely. They have had economic impact on Russia. I mean, make no mistake, but really quite minimal in relation to the drop of the oil prices. I do believe that Russians need sanctions lifted in the coming year, and that is because, one, Russian economy cannot grow without access to Western capital, and two, they will have real budgetary issues because they've been running a deficit and they have been using up their reserve funds. And I think both of those in the second quarter of next year are going to really come home to bite. So they will look for an opportunity, if not in December, to get sanctions lifted, then maybe 6 months from then. Sanctions, if you remember, the important ones get renewed July to January, January to July.
Well, Michael Kaufman, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on your program.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Kaufman, who's a fellow at the Wilson Center's Cannon Institute, who has represented the Department of Defense in a number of Track 1 and Track 2 efforts with Russia and Pakistan. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Putin's Military is Playing the Long Game in Ukraine. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining Donald Trump's immigration proposals with the former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service.
We expected something better than before. We expected something more. Do you really think you can just put it in a safe behind a painting, lock it up and leave? Do you really think you can just put it in a safe behind a painting, lock it up and leave?
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Doris Meisner, the former commissioner of the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service under President Bill Clinton, and a senior fellow at Migration Policy Institute, where she directs the Institute's U.S. immigration policy work. Welcome to Background Briefing, Doris Meisner.
Thank you.
And the speech that Donald Trump gave recently in Arizona after having gone to Mexico to meet with Mexico's president caught a lot of people by surprise, in as much as there was that sort of moment where Trump could be considered presidential standing up beside a foreign leader. It's rather puzzling to understand why the president of Mexico offered Trump such a photo opportunity, but he clearly made the best of it. But then he returned to the United States and gave, I think, probably one of his most divisive, hateful speeches that really, as for the work that you've done and the positions you've held in your career, Doris Meisner, he's turned America's tradition of immigration up totally inside out and topsy-turvy, and not to mention the inscription on the Statue of Liberty, which just says, give me your tie, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. It's like putting up a sign, get out, no trespassing, whatever. Do you think it was as radical a change as I am expressing?
Well, it's certainly not so surprising given the course of the entire campaign. I mean, after all, he staked his presidential bid from the very first day that he announced it on immigration. He started right out by talking about people coming, about Mexico sending to the United States its criminals, its rapists, its problems. And he's been true to that theme ever since. So his suggestion, his proposals for a wall with Mexico, for deporting everybody in the United States who doesn't have legal status, and then adding to that the ban on Muslims and the extreme vetting, ban on Syrian refugees, those have all been ideas that have been in the primaries and that have been part of the discourse now for 15 months. The speech that he gave in Arizona had been planned for several weeks. It's the trip to Mexico that popped up as an opportunity in the course of the timing of that speech. He obviously took the opportunity, as you suggest, it gave him a great way to be with a foreign leader. But the speech itself was being advertised and worked on for quite some while. And in fact, it had been delayed by about a week because there was real disagreement within the Trump camp on where he really stood on some of the particulars. So, yes, the tone was extraordinarily angry, and it certainly was a rebuke just a few hours later on the very same day to the demeanor and the message that came with the Mexico City meeting. But the overall thrust of it is what we've been hearing now for more than a year.
But is it his policies, as they were enunciated, seem to sort of fly in the face of what we've understood is the American dream for people who come here? They usually come from countries escaping repression. They're here in a free country where they're able to flourish through hard work. It's always been understood that that's been what's happened, that we just had opened the door to people who appreciate the freedoms that America offers and understand the virtues of hard work and have all become successful. All of us are relatives of those very same people. But now he's talking about only accepting some, having some kind of patriotic test, and basically more or less saying that we're letting in the riffraff of the world. I mean, how does that strike you, having been in charge of Immigration and Naturalization Service?
Well, you know, the story that you're relating has certainly been the dominant understanding that we've had of immigration. And if you poll people, the public in general, they would largely agree with the way you've described it. But there also is a population and a part of the population of the United States that has strongly disagreed with that. Immigration has always been a controversial issue, and it's controversial today just as it has been in the past. And what Donald Trump's candidacy is doing is pushing out into the open that disagreement and giving voice to that part of the public that contests that immigration is good for the United States. So, you know, what's taking place here is a real struggle over what the immigration idea really does mean in America today. And he's making a very strong case that depicts immigration as a threat to the United States, as a way of taking the American identity away as a serious issue in the economy. And what we're seeing, of course, is that although it's a minority so far, it's a very vocal minority of the public that agrees with that view.
So is that to suggest then, Doris Meinzer, that there's a sort of political DNA that's been revived? Because the Know-Nothing movement back in the 1850s sprang out of the Whig Party and eventually morphed into the Republican Party. But their basis, I mean, it was obviously an anti-intellectual nativist party. The idea that if you ask them what you stand for, they said, we know nothing. But they were essentially anti-immigrant, I believe largely against the Catholic immigrants that were coming in because of the potato famine in Ireland. But it does certainly have similarities, does it not, you know, with Trump is against Muslims.
I think the really deeper point here is that immigration is something that it defines us as a nation. It's what's created us as a nation. It's part of our comparative advantage as a nation today, just as it has been in the past. But it's never been an easy process, and it's always been strongly contested and controversial. And we're seeing that again, and particularly we're seeing it in the way that this candidacy is tapping into that history and that sense among some in the country that this is the wrong direction for the country to be going. Now, you know, immigration is, as I said, it's one of the hard, it's difficult to do when it's happening, and there definitely are people who are winners and people who are losers. And those people where there is some competition tends to be people that are less educated, have less than a high school education, and in the current situation, current times that we live in, are really affected negatively by globalization. So the globalization of the economy, the outward-looking nature of the economy and the competition that that brings with it, immigration tends to be the proxy for many of those broader difficulties, and immigrants represent the face of those changes that for many have been difficult to accept.
Well, I myself am an immigrant and became naturalized and found the ceremony itself, even though I was among 5,316 other people in a big convention center downtown Los Angeles, I found it extremely moving ceremony, and I think everybody that was there did, and it was a wonderful kind of rainbow coalition of people from around the world present. And everybody, I think, found it to be a very joyful occasion. And there was no kind of loyalty oath in the way that Donald Trump is talking about. And mm-hmm. he talks about extreme vetting. I don't quite know what it means and who would be allowed in future in Trump's America to become a citizen. But, you know, the loyalty oath that you give is basically what every government employee gives. It's what every person in the military gives. You know, you swear to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. And that seems to be sufficient. I don't understand what he's talking about. Do you?
No, I don't. And I certainly subscribe to what you're describing about naturalization and naturalization ceremonies. It was, when I was in the government, was the my most favorite part of the job. And I've always felt that every American should observe a naturalization ceremony. I think it should be part of everybody's seventh grade curriculum or whatever, because it does really remind you of what the country is about, what the history of the country is about, and how people who are newly arrived cherish and value the opportunities that they have. But as I've said before, that is not an entirely shared view. Now, what extreme vetting might be, we can only guess. The it seems to me that when people immigrate and either join family in the United States or come here because of an employer or an employment opportunity, which are largely the ways that people come, certainly also as refugees, that in all of those cases, it's implicit that they embrace the United States and that they are intending to contribute, and certainly that they embrace American values. But it's also the case that we live in a post-9/11 world. There are people who mean the country harm. And so if one wants to magnify, or not even magnify, if one wants to focus purely on that aspect of coming to the country, then one gets to and is sympathetic with what Donald Trump is saying, which is that we have to be very careful who we admit. We are very careful with who we admit. We have very intensive screening procedures. We have, as a country, invested significantly since 9/11 in our systems for screening people, in collecting biometric fingerprints of everybody that comes into the country, in sharing intelligence with like-minded countries around the world, in integrating databases across government agencies at the federal level, as well as sharing information federal, state, and local. So there is an enormous amount of effort, modernized, newly developed effort, that is in place and is constantly being improved, that recognizes that it's a dangerous world. But the campaign and the candidacy that we see coming from Donald Trump is one that focuses on the dangers rather than the focus that you're putting on the positives.
But much of what Trump laid out as prescriptions for, you know, having given this exaggerated and paranoid vision of America being overrun by criminals and Muslim terrorists, etc., nevertheless, the prescriptions that he put forth are exactly the ones that exist today, that under President Obama, you know, the priority is to deport criminal aliens. That's my understanding. The problem seems to be that, in particular with, you know, the MS-13 and 18th Street gangs that started here in Los Angeles, went back to El Salvador and have something of a revolving door, that seems to be a problem. When he cites people like the Boston bombers, they came in, I believe, as refugees. There are holes in the system. And are there ways to fix that without being demagogic?
Well, you're correct that the deportation of criminals is the highest priority for this administration, has been for prior administrations. This administration, the Obama administration, has deported more than 3 million people, a large share of them criminal aliens. That's more deportations than any other previous president. So there is a great deal of attention being paid to the criminal element. Now, the Boston bombers, for instance, they were born in the United States. They were U.S. citizens. They were the children of people who came as immigrants. There certainly can always be ways that these systems break down. At the same time, the systems are sophisticated. They are well-funded. And the question really is whether one is going to largely shut down immigration, particularly of refugee groups and others who are deeply victimized by terrorism and by ISIS, or work to be sure that the screening continues to be as precise and as careful as we can make it. So what Donald Trump is talking about is a zero-tolerance approach. In general, what the United States has been successful in doing is having a very carefully carried out risk management approach, that recognizes that, yes, there are dangers in the world, but there also are very important positive attributes to maintaining a healthy immigration system.
But in terms of, say, the MS-13 El Salvadoran gang, which actually creates an immigration problem in El Salvador because the country is so lawless because of they're such predators, they do tend to come back. At least that's my understanding. And that, of course, plays into Trump's hands about his wall. But much of what he said, for example, he said we're going to increase the Border Patrol. My understanding is that the Border Patrol has been increased enormously. I think it's the biggest American police force, is it not?
Absolutely. The Border Patrol now stands at about 21,000. That's double or more what it was just in the last 10 years. The numbers of people coming across the southwest border now are at a 40-year low. The story and the imagery that Donald Trump is projecting about the southwest border is really at least 10 years old, if not longer. But those fears remain in people's minds. Now, gangs and MS-13, those are transnational criminal networks. You're correct in saying that to a great extent they originated in the United States. And in a country like El Salvador, that is a small country where we have very large numbers of deportations, and the majority of those deportations are, in fact, criminal aliens, that has created and fed transnational networks. The other thing, of course, that has fed transnational criminal networks is the drug trade and the appetite for drugs in the United States that is met by drug trafficking through Central America and from South America. So these are deeply connected and interconnected phenomena, but where return across the southwest border is concerned, it is less and less. We are at a point where there are now more people net per year that return to Mexico than come to the United States from Mexico. So one has to ultimately ask the question, how much more investment in southwest border enforcement is needed in terms of the return on that investment? Donald Trump's answer is a great deal more. Most law enforcement professionals, including the Department of Homeland Security, would say that the amount of investment that has been made needs to be kept up, but that there isn't very much greater return on investment that is likely, particularly given the fact that the flows are coming down.
Well, Doris Mizer, I appreciate your time, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Doris Mizer, who's the former commissioner of the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service under President Bill Clinton, and a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, where she directs the Institute's U.S. immigration policy work. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.